The dark-haired girl strode past the window, and Stella turned her head to watch her cross the town square and go up the steps of the Archer Hotel. Her companion, an associate professor of anthropology at the nearby SUNY college, named Harold Sims, said, "The scrutiny one beautiful woman gives another, but I've never seen you do it before, Stell." She, who detested being called Stell, said, "Did you think she was beautiful?" "I'd be a liar if I said I didn't." "Well, if you think I'm beautiful, too, I guess it's all right." She smiled rather automatically at Sims, who was 20 years younger than herself and infatuated, and looked back at the Archer Hotel, where the tall young woman was just negotiating the door and disappearing within. "If it's all right, why are you staring?" "Oh, it's just..." Stella closed her mouth. "It's just nothing at all. That's the sort of woman you ought to be taking to lunch, not a battered old monument like me."
"Jesus, if you think that,"
Sim said and tried to take her hand beneath the table. She brushed his hand aside with a touch of her fingers. Stella Hawthorne had never appreciated being fondled in restaurants. She would have liked to have given his paw a good hard slap.
"Stella, give me a break."
She looked straight into his mild brown eyes and said,
"Hadn't you better get back to all your nice little students?"
In the meantime, the young woman was checking into the hotel. Mrs. Hardy, who had been running the Archer Hotel with her son since the death of her husband, emerged from her office and came up to the lovely young person on the other side of the desk.
"May I help you?" she asked,
and thought, "How am I going to keep Jim from this one?"
"I'll need a room with a bath," the girl said. "I'd like to stay here until I can find a place to rent somewhere in town." "Oh, how nice," said Mrs. Hardy. "You're moving to Milburn? Well, I think that's real sweet. Most all the young people here nowadays just can't wait to get out. Like my Jim, he'll take your bags up. He thinks every day here is another day in jail. New York is where he wants to go. Would that be where you're from?"
"I've lived there, but some of my family lived here once."
"Well, here are our rates, and here's the register," said Mrs. Hardy.
Sliding a mimeographed sheet of paper in the big leather-bound register across the counter to her,
"You'll find this a real nice, quiet hotel. Most of the folks here are residential, just like a boarding house, really, but with the service of a hotel, and no loud parties at night."
The young woman had nodded at the rates and was signing the register.
"No discos, not on your life. And I have to tell you straight off, no man in your room past 11.
"Fine," the girl said, turning the register back to Mrs. Hardy, who read the name written in a clear, elegant handwriting.
Anna Mostyn, with an address given in the West 80s in New York.
"Oh, that's good," said Mrs. Hardy. "You never know how girls will take that these days, but..."
She looked up at the new guest's face and was stopped short by the indifference in the long blue eyes. Her first, almost unconscious thought was, "She's a cold one." And this was followed by the perfectly conscious reflection that this girl would have no trouble handling Jim.
"Anna's such a nice old-fashioned name."
"Yes."
Mrs. Hardy, a little disconcerted, rang the bell for her son.
"I'm really a very old-fashioned sort of person," the girl said.
"Didn't you say you had family here in town?"
"I did, but it was a long time ago."
"It's just that I didn't recognize the name."
"No, you wouldn't. An aunt of mine lived here once. Her name was Eva Galley, but you probably wouldn't have known her."
Ricky's wife, sitting alone in the restaurant, suddenly snapped her fingers and exclaimed,
I'm getting old.
She had remembered of whom the girl had reminded her. The waiter, a high school dropout by the look of him, bent over the table, not quite sure how to give her the bill after the gentleman had stormed off and uttered, "Huh?"
"Oh, get away, you fool," she said,
wondering why it was that while one half of high school dropouts looked like thugs, the other half resembled physicists.
"Oh, here, better give me the bill before you faint."
Jim Hardy kept sneaking looks at her all the way up the stairs, and once he had opened her room and put her suitcase down, offered,
"I hope you're gonna stick around a good long time."
"I thought your mother said you hated Milburn."
"I don't hate it so much anymore," he said,
giving her the look which had melted Penny Drager in the back seat of his car the previous night.
"Why?"
"Ah,"
he said, not knowing how to continue in the face of her total refusal to be melted.
"You know."
"I do."
"Look, I just mean you're a goddamn great-looking lady, that's all. You know what I mean. You got a lot of style."
He decided to be bolder than he felt.
"Ladies with style turn me on."
"Do they?"
"Yeah,"
he nodded. He couldn't figure her out. If she was a non-starter, she would have told him to leave at the beginning. But though she let him hang around, she wasn't looking interested or flattered. She wasn't even looking amused. Then she surprised him by doing what he had been half-hoping she would do, and took off her coat. She wasn't much in the chest department, but she had good legs. Then, entirely without warning, a total awareness of her body assaulted him, a blast of pure sensuality. Nothing like the steamy posturing of Penny Drager or the other high school girls he had bedded. A wave of pure and cold sensuality which dwindled him.
"Ah,"
he said, desperately hoping she would not send him away.
"I bet you had some kind of great job in the city. What are you, in television or something?"
"No,"
he fidgeted.
"Well, it's not like I don't know your address or anything. Maybe I could drop in sometime, have a talk."
"Maybe. Do you talk?"
"Ha! Yeah, well, guess I better get back downstairs. I mean, I got a lot of storm windows to put up this cold weather we got."
She sat on the bed and held her hand out. Half reluctantly, he went toward her. When he touched her hand, she placed a neatly folded dollar bill in his palm.
"I'll tell you what I think," she said. "I think bellboys shouldn't wear jeans. They look sloppy."
He accepted the dollar, too confused to thank her, and fled. It was Ann Veronica Moore, thought Stella, that actress at John's house the night Edward died. Stella allowed the intimidated boy to hold her fur coat. Ann Veronica Moore, why should I think of her? I only saw her for a few minutes, and that girl really didn't resemble her at all. 4.
"No," Sears continued, "I was resolved to help that poor creature, Fenny Bate. I didn't think there was such a thing as a bad boy, unless misunderstanding and cruelty were to make him bad, and that you could redress. So I began a little reclamation program. When Fenny tipped over his desk the next day, I righted it myself, much to the disgust of the older children, and at lunchtime I asked him to stay inside with me. The other children filed out, buzzing with speculation. I'm sure they thought I was going to cane him once they were out of sight. And then I noticed that his sister was lurking in the dark rear corner. 'I won't hurt him, Constance,' I said. 'You can stay behind, too, if you wish.' Those poor children. I can still see both of them, with their bad teeth and tattered clothing. he full of suspicion and resentment and fear, and she simply fearful for him. She crept into a chair, and I went to work to try to straighten out some of Fenny's misconceptions. I told him all the stories of explorers I knew about Lewis and Clark and Cortez and Nansen and Ponce de Leon, stuff I was going to use later in class. But it had no effect on Fenny. He knew that the world went only about 40 or 50 miles out from Four Forks, and that the people within this radius were the world's population. He clung to this notion with the dogged stubbornness of the stupid. "Who in the world told you this, Fenny?" I asked. He shook his head. "Did you make it up yourself?" He shook his head again. "Was it your parents?" Back in the dark corner, Constance giggled. Giggled without any humor. That laugh of hers sent chills through me. It conjured up pictures of a nearly bestial life. Of course, that was what they had, and all the other children knew it. And as I found out later, it was much worse, much more unnatural than anything I could have imagined. Anyhow, I raised my hands in despair or impatience, and the wretched girl must have thought I was going to strike him because she called out,
"It was Gregory!"
Fenny looked back at her, and I swear that I've never seen anyone look so frightened. In the next instant, he was off his chair and out of the schoolroom. I tried to call him back, but it was no good. He was running as if for life, off into the woods, sprinting in the jackrabbit country way. The girl hung in the doorway, watching him go. And now she looked frightened and dismayed. Her whole being had turned pale. "Who is Gregory, Constance?" I asked her, and her face twisted. "Does he sometimes walk by the schoolhouse? Is his hair like this?" And I stuck my hands up over my head, my fingers spread wide. And then she was off too, running as fast as he had. Well, that afternoon I was accepted by the other students. They'd assumed that I had beaten both of the big children, and so taken part in the natural order of things. And that night at dinner I got, if not an extra potato, at least a sort of congealed smile from Sophronia Mather. Evidently Ethel Birdwood had reported to her mother that the new schoolmaster had seen reason. Fenny and Constance didn't come to school the next 2 days. I stewed about that, and thought that I'd acted so clumsily that they might never return. On the second day, I was so restless that I paced around the schoolyard during lunchtime. The children regarded me as they would a dangerous lunatic. It was clear that teacher was supposed to stay indoors, preferably administering the ferule. Then I heard something that stopped me dead and made me whirl around toward a group of girls who were sitting rather primly on the grass. They were the biggest girls, and one of them was Ethel Birdwood. I was sure that I'd heard her mention the name Gregory. "Tell me about Gregory, Ethel," I said.
"What's Gregory?" she asked, simpering. "There's no one with that name here."
She gave me a great cow-eyed look, and I was certain she was thinking of that rural tradition of the schoolmaster marrying his eldest female pupil. She was a confident girl, this Ethel Birdwood, and her father had the reputation of being prosperous. I wasn't having it.
"I just heard you mention his name." "You must be mistaken, Mr. James," she said, dripping honey.
"I do not feel charitable to liars," I said. "Tell me about this Gregory person." "Of course, they all assumed that I was threatening her with a caning." Another girl came to her rescue.
"We were saying that Gregory fixed that gutter," she said,
and pointed to the side of the school. One of the rain gutters was obviously new. "Well, he'll never come around this school again if I can help it," I said, and left them to their infuriating giggling. After school that day, I thought I'd visit the lion's den, as it were, and walk up to the Bait home. I knew it was about as far out of town as Lewis's house is from Milburn. I set off on the most likely road and walked quite a way, 3 or 4 miles, when I realized I'd probably gone too far. I hadn't passed any houses, so the Bait home had to be actually in the woods themselves, instead of on their edge as I had imagined. I took a likely-looking trail, and I thought I would simply tack back and forth toward town until I found them. Unfortunately, I got lost. I went into ravines and up hills and through scrub until I couldn't have told you where even the road was anymore. It all looked appallingly alike. Then, just at dusk, I was aware of being watched. It was a remarkably uncanny feeling. It was like knowing a tiger was behind me, about to pounce. I turned around to put my back against a big elm, and then I saw something. A man stepped into a clearing about 30 yards from me. The man I had seen before. Gregory, or so I thought. He said nothing, and neither did I. He just gazed at me, absolutely silent, with that wild hair and that ivory face. I felt hatred, absolute hatred, streaming from him. An air of utter, unreasonable violence hung about him, along with that peculiar freedom I had sensed earlier. He was like a madman. He could have killed me off in those woods, and no one would have known. And trust me, what I saw in his face was murder, nothing else. Just as I expected him to come forward and attack me, he stepped behind a tree. I went forward very slowly. "What do you want?" I called, simulating bravery. There was no answer. I went forward a bit more. Finally, I got to the tree where I had seen him, and there wasn't a trace of him. He had just melted away. I was still lost, and I still felt threatened, for that was the meaning of his appearance, I knew. It was a threat. I took a few steps off in a random direction, passed through another thick stand of trees, and stopped short. For a moment, I was scared. Right before me, closer than that apparition had been, was a thin, shabbily dressed girl with stringy blonde hair. Constance Bait. "Where's Fenny?" I asked. She raised one bony arm and pointed off to the side. Then he too rose up like a snake from a basket. I must admit, is the metaphor that comes to mind. On his face, when he stood up in the tall weeds, was that characteristic Fenny Bait expression of sullen guilt. "I was looking for your home," I said, and they both pointed at once in the same direction, again without speaking. Looking through a chink in the woods, I saw a tar-paper shack with one grease-paper window and a stingy little pipe of a chimney. You used to see a lot of tar-paper shacks here and there, though thank goodness they have disappeared now. But that one was the most sordid I ever did see. I know I have the reputation of being a conservative, but I've never equated virtue with money nor poverty with vice. Yet that mean, stinking little shack, looking at it, you knew it stank. Somehow for me appeared to breathe foulness. No, it was worse than that. It wasn't merely that the lives within would be brutalized by poverty, but that they would be twisted, malformed. My heart fell. I looked away and saw an emaciated black dog nosing at a dead cushion of feathers that must have been a chicken once. This, surely, I thought, must be how Finney got the reputation for being bad. The prim folks of Four Forks had taken one look at his home and condemned him for life. Yet I didn't want to go in there. I didn't believe in evil, but evil was what I felt. I turned back to the children, who had the oddest frozen look in their eyes. "I want to see you in school tomorrow," I said. Fenny shook his head. "But I want to help you," I said. I was on the verge of making a speech. What I wanted to say to him was that it was my plan to change his life, to rescue him, in a sense, I suppose, to make him human. That obstinate, frozen look on his mug stopped me. There was something else in it, too, and I realized with a shock that something about Fenny was reminding me of my last glimpse of the mysterious Gregory. "You must come back to school tomorrow," I said. Constance said,
"Gregory doesn't want us to. Gregory said we have to stay here."
"Well, what I say is he comes and you come too."
"I'll ask Gregory."
"Oh, to hell with Gregory," I shouted. "You'll come," and walked away from the two of them. That queer sensation stayed with me until I found the road again. It was like walking away from damnation. You can guess what the result was. They did not return. Things ticked on in their normal way for several days, Ethel Birdwood and some of the other girls giving me liquid glances whenever I called on them for an answer, me toiling over the next day's lessons in that frigid box of a room, and rising, extremely unlike Phoebus, with the dawn to prepare the schoolhouse. Eventually, Ethel began bringing me sandwiches for lunch, and soon my other admirers among the girls were bringing sandwiches, too. I used to save one in my pocket to eat in my room after supper with the Mathers. On Sundays, I made the long hike to Footville for my required visit to the Lutheran church there. It was not as deadly as I had feared. The minister was an old German, Franz Gruber, who called himself Dr. Gruber. The doctorate was genuine. He was a much subtler man than his gross body or residence in Footville, New York, suggested. I thought his sermons were interesting, and I decided to speak to him. When the Bate children finally appeared, they seemed worn and tired, like drinkers after a strenuous night. This became a pattern. They'd miss 2 days, come in, miss three, come in for two. And each time I saw them, they looked worse. Fenny, in particular, seemed in decline. It was as though he were aging prematurely. He grew even thinner. His skin seemed to crease on his forehead and at the corners of his eyes. And when I saw him, I could swear that he looked as though he were smirking at me. Fenny Bate smirking, though I would have sworn that he didn't possess the mental equipment for it. For him, it seemed corrupt. It frightened me. Therefore, one Sunday after the service, I spoke to Dr. Gruber at the church door. I waited to be last to shake his hand, and when everybody else had filed away down the road, I told him that I wanted his advice on a problem. He must have thought that I was going to confess to an adultery or some such. He was very kind and invited me into his home across the street from the church. Very graciously, he escorted me into his library. It was a large room, entirely book-lined. I hadn't seen a room like it since I'd left Harvard. It was obviously the room of a scholar. It was a room where a man comfortable with ideas worked with them. Most of the books were in German, but many were in Latin and Greek. He had the patristic writings in big soft leather folios, Bible commentaries, works of theology and the great aid to sermon writers, a Bible concordance. On a shelf behind his desk, I was surprised to see a little collection of Lully, Flood, Bruno, what you would call the occult studies of the Renaissance. Also, even more surprisingly, a few antiquarian books about witchcraft and Satanism. Dr. Gruber had been out of the room fetching beer, and when he came in, he saw me looking at these books. "What you see," he said in his guttural accent, "is the reason you find me in Footville, Mr. James. I hope you will not think me a cracked old fool on the evidence of those books." Without my prompting him, he told me the story, and it's as you'd expect. He'd been brilliant, approved of by his elders. He had written books himself. But when he had shown too much interest in what he called hermetic matters, he was ordered to stop that line of study. He'd published one further paper and been banished to the most out-of-the-way congregation the Lutheran establishment could find. "Now," he said, "my cards are on the table. As my new countrymen say, I never speak of these hermetic matters in my sermons, but I continue my studies in them. You are free to go or to speak as you please." This sounded a little pompous to me, and I was a little taken aback, but I saw no reason not to continue. I told him the whole story, not stinting on the detail. He listened with great attentiveness, and it was clear that he had heard of Gregory and the Bate children. More than that, he seemed to be very excited by the story. When I finished, he said, "And all of this happened just as you have explained?" "Of course." "You have spoken of it to no one else?"
"No."
"I am very happy you have come to me," he said, and instead of saying anything further, pulled a gigantic pipe out of a desk drawer, filled it, and began to smoke, all the while fixing me with his protuberant eyes. I began to feel uneasy, and half regretted that I had taken his earlier comments so lightly. "Your landlady never gave you any idea of why she thought Fanny Bate was badness itself?"
I shook my head, trying to rid myself of the negative impression I'd just had of him. "Do you know why she would?"
"It is a well-known story," he answered. "In these two little towns, actually, it is quite a famous story."
"Is Fanny bad?" I asked.
"He is not bad, but he is corrupt," said Dr. Gruber. "But from what you say,
it could be worse." "I confess," I said, "it's entirely a mystery."
"More so than you imagine," he said calmly. "If I try to explain it to you, you will be tempted, on the basis of what you know about me, to think me insane."
His eyes bulged even more. "If Fanny is corrupt," I asked, "who corrupted him?"
"Oh, Gregory," he replied. "Gregory, without doubt. Gregory's in back of it all."
"But who is Gregory?" I had to ask.
"The man you saw. I'm positive of that. You have described him perfectly."
He held his pudgy fingers up behind his head, imitating my own gesture to Constance Bate.
"Perfectly, I assure you. Yet when you hear more, you will doubt my word."
"For the sake of heaven, why?" He shook his head, and I saw that his free hand was trembling. For a second I wondered if I really had stumbled into intimate conversation with a madman.
Fenny's parents had 3 children, he said, puffing out smoke. Gregory Bate was the first.
He is their brother, I exclaimed. One day I thought I saw a resemblance. Yes, I see. But there's nothing unnatural in that.
That depends, I think, on what passed between them.
I tried to take it in. You mean something unnatural passed between them?
And with the sister as well.
A feeling of horror went through me. I could see that cold, handsome face and that hateful, careless manner, Gregory's air of being free of all restraint. Between Gregory and the sister.
And, as I said, between Gregory and Fenny.
He corrupted both of them, then. Why isn't Constance as condemned by 4 Forks as Fenny?
Remember, schoolteacher, that this is the hinterland. A touch of unnaturalness between brother and sister among those wretched families in shacks is perhaps not so unnatural after all.
But between brother and brother, I might have been back at Harvard discussing a savage tribe with a professor of anthropology.
It is.
By God, it is, I exclaimed, seeing that crafty, prematurely aged expression on Fenny's face. And now he is trying to send me off. He sees me as an interference.
Apparently he does. I hope you see why.
Because I won't stand for it, I said. He wants to get rid of me.
Ah, he said. Gregory wants everything.
You mean he wants them forever?
Both of them forever. But from your story, perhaps Fenny most of all.
Can't their parents stop this?
The mother is dead.
The father left when Gregory grew old enough to beat him. They live alone in that appalling place. He nodded. It was terrible. It meant the miasma, the sense of the place is somehow damned, came from the children themselves, from what happened between them and Gregory. Well, I protested, can't the children themselves do something to protect themselves?
They did, he said.
But what? I had prayer in mind, I suppose, since I was talking with a preacher, or boarding with another family. But as to that, my own experience had shown me how far charity went in 4 Forks.
You won't take my word for it, he said. So I must show you.
He abruptly stood up and gestured for me to stand as well.
Outside, he ordered.
Beneath his excitement, he seemed very disturbed, and just for a moment I thought that he found me as unpleasant as I did him, with his showers of pipe tobacco and his bulging eyes. I left the room and, on the way out of the house, passed a room with a table set for one. I smelled a roast cooking, and an open bottle of beer sat on the table, so it could be that all he disliked was being kept from his lunch. He slammed the door behind us and set off back toward the church. This was mystifying indeed. When he had crossed the road, he called to me without turning his head.
You know that Gregory was the school handyman? That he used to do odd jobs around the school.
One of the girls said something about it, I replied, watching him continue on around the side of the church. What next, I wondered, a trip into the fields? And what would I have to be shown before I would believe it? A little graveyard lay behind the church, and I had time following waddling Dr. Gruber to idly look at the names on the massive 19th-century tombstones. Josiah Foote, Sarah Foote, all of that clan which had founded the village, and other names which meant nothing to me. Dr. Gruber was now standing with a decided air of impatience by a little gate at the back of the graveyard.
"Here,"
he said. Well, I thought, if you're too lazy to open it for yourself, and bent down to lift the latch.
"Not that," he said sharply. "Look down. Look at the cross."
I looked where he was pointing. It was a crude, hand-painted wooden cross, standing where a tombstone would, at the head of a grave. Someone had lettered the name Gregory Bate on the horizontal piece of the cross. I looked back up at Dr. Gruber, and there was no doubt this time. He was looking at me with distaste. "It can't be," I said. "It's preposterous. I saw him." "Believe me, schoolteacher, this is where your rival is buried," he said. And not for a long time after did I notice his peculiar choice of words. "The mortal portion of him, at any rate." I was numb. I repeated what I had said. "It can't be." He ignored my remark. "One night a year ago, Gregory Bate was doing some work in the schoolyard. While doing it, he looked up and noticed, I imagine this is what happened, that the rain gutter required some attention. And he went around to the back of the school and got the ladder and went up. Fanny and Constance saw their chance to escape his tyranny and knocked the ladder out from under him. He fell, struck his head on the corner of the building, and died." "What were they doing there at night?" He shrugged. "He always took them with him. They had been sitting in the playground." "I don't believe that they killed him on purpose," I said. "Howard Hummel, the postmaster, saw them running off. It was he who found Gregory's body." "So nobody actually saw it happen." "Nobody had to actually see it, Mr. James. What happened was clear to all." "It's not clear to me," I said, and he shrugged again. "What did they do afterward?" "They ran. It must have been obvious that they had succeeded. The back of his head was crushed. Fanny and his sister disappeared for 3 weeks. They hid out in the woods. By the time they realized they had nowhere to go and returned home, we had buried Gregory. Howard Hummel had told what he had seen, and people assumed what they assumed. Hence, you see, Fenny's badness." "But now," I said, looking down at the crudely lettered grave. The children must have made and lettered the cross, I realized, and suddenly that seemed the most gruesome detail of all. "Oh, yes, now. Now, Gregory wants him back." "From what you tell me, he has him back. He has both of them back. But I imagine that he will wish to remove Fanny from your influence." He pronounced this last word with a meticulous Germanic precision. It chilled me. "To take him.
To take him."
"Can't I save him?" I said, almost pleading.
"I suspect at least no one else can," he said, looking at me as from a great distance.
"Can't you help, for God's sake?"
"Not even for his. From what you say, it has gone too far. We do not believe in exorcisms in my church."
"You just believe," I was furious and scornful.
"In evil, yes, we do believe in that."
I turned away from him. He must have imagined that I was going to return and beg him for help, but when I kept on walking, he called out,
"Take care, schoolteacher!"
Walking home, I was in a sort of daze. I could scarcely believe or accept what had seemed irrefutable while I talked with the preacher. Yet he had shown me the grave, and I had seen with my own eyes the transformation in Fenny. I had seen Gregory. It is not too much to say that I had felt him. The impression he made on me was that strong. And then I stopped walking, about a mile from Four Forks, faced with proof that Gregory Bate knew exactly what I had discovered and knew exactly what I had intended. One of the farmer's fields there formed a large, wide, bare hill visible from the road, and he was up on the hill staring down at me. He didn't move a muscle when I saw him, but his intensity quivered out of him, and I must have jumped a foot. He was looking at me as though he could read every thought in my head. Far up in the clouds above him, a hawk was circling aimlessly. Any trace of doubt left me. I knew that everything Gruber had told me was true. It was all I could do not to run, but I would not show cowardice before him, no matter how cowardly I felt. He was waiting for me to run, I imagine, standing up there with his arms hanging straight and his pale face visible as only a white smudge and all that feeling arrowing toward me. I forced myself to continue home at a walk. Dinner I could scarcely force myself to swallow. I had no more than a bite or two. Mather said, "If you'll starve yourself, there's more for the rest of us. It's no matter to me." I faced him directly. Did Fenny Bate have a brother as well as a sister? He looked at me with as much curiosity as he possessed. "Well, did he?"
"He did."
"What was the brother's name?"
"It was Gregory, but I'll thank you to refrain from speaking about him."
"Were you afraid of him?" I asked, because I saw fear on both his face and his wife's.
"Please, Mr. James," said Sophronia Mather, "this will do no good."
"Nobody speaks of that Gregory Bate," her husband said.
"What happened to him?" I asked. He stopped chewing and put down his fork.
"I don't know what you heard or who you heard it from, but I'll tell you this. If any man was damned, it was that Gregory Bate, and whatever happened to him was deserved. That's an end to talk of Gregory Bate."
Then he pushed more food into his mouth, and the discussion was over. Mrs. Mather kept her eyes religiously on her plate for the rest of the meal. I was in a stew. Neither of the two Bate children appeared in school for 2 or 3 days, and it was almost as though I had dreamed the whole affair. I went through the motions of teaching, but my mind was with them, especially poor Fenny and the danger he was in. What, above all, kept the horror before me was that I saw Gregory in town one day. Because it was a Saturday, Four Forks was filled with farmers and their wives who came in for their shopping. Every Saturday the little town had almost a fairground look, at least in contrast to the way it looked normally. The sidewalks were crowded and the stores were busy. Dozens of horses stamped in the street, and everywhere you saw the eager faces of kids, all piled into the backs of wagons, their eyes wide open with being in town. I recognized many of my pupils and waved to some of them. Then a big farmer I'd never met before tapped my shoulder and said that he knew I was his son's teacher and that he wanted to shake my hand. I thanked him and listened to him talk for a bit. Then I saw Gregory over his shoulder. Gregory was leaning against the side of the post office, indifferent to everything about him, and staring at me, just intently staring, as he must have been doing from the hilltop. My mouth dried up, and something obviously showed in my face because my pupil's father stopped talking and asked me if I felt all right. "Oh, yes," I said, but it must have looked as if I were being deliberately rude because I kept looking over his shoulder. No one else could see Gregory. They just walked by him, carrying on in the normal way, looking right through him. Now, where I had seen that abandoned freedom, I could see only depravity. I made some excuse to the farmer, a headache, an abscessed tooth, and turned back to Gregory. He was gone. He had vanished during the few seconds I was saying goodbye to the farmer. So I knew that the showdown was coming and that he would pick the time and place. The next time Fanny and Constance came to school, I was determined that I would protect them. They were both pale and quiet, and enough of an aura of strangeness enveloped them for the other children to leave them alone. It was perhaps 4 days since my seeing their brother leaning against the Four Forks post office. I could not imagine what had been happening to them since I had last seen them. But it was as though a wasting disease had hold of them. They seemed so lost and apart, those ragged, backward children. I was determined to keep them under my protection. When the lessons for the day were over, I kept them back as the others raced for home. They sat uncomplaining at their desks, stricken and dumb. "Why did he let you come to school?" I asked. Fanny looked at me blankly and said,
"Who?"
I was dumbfounded.
"Gregory, of course."
Fanny shook his head as if to blow away fog.
"Gregory? We ain't seen Gregory for a long time. No, not for a long time now."
Now I was shocked. They were wan from his absence. "Then what do you do with yourselves?"
"We go over."
"Go over?" Constance nodded, agreeing with Fanny.
"We go over."
"Go over where? Go over what?" Now they were both looking at me with their mouths open as if I were very dense. "Go over to meet Gregory?" It was horrible, but I could think of nothing else. Fanny shook his head.
"We don't never see Gregory."
"No," said Constance. I was horrified to hear regret in her voice.
"We just go over."
Fanny seemed to come to life for a moment. He said,
"But I heard him once. He said this is all there is, and there ain't no more. There ain't nothing but this. There ain't nothing like you said, like on maps. It ain't there."
"Then what's out there instead?" I asked.
"It's like what we see," Fanny said.
"See?"
"When we go," he answered.
"What do you see?" I asked.
"It's nice," Constance said,
and put her head on the desk.
"It's real nice."
I didn't have the faintest idea of what they were talking about, but I didn't like the sound of it much, and I thought I'd have time later to talk about it further. "Well, nobody's going anywhere tonight," I said. "I want both of you to stay here with me tonight. I want to keep you safe." Fanny nodded, but stupidly and half-heartedly, as if he didn't care much where he spent his nights. And when I looked to Constance for agreement, I saw that she had fallen asleep. "All right, then," I said. "We can fix up places to sleep later, and tomorrow I'll try to find beds for you in the village. You two children can't stay out in the woods on your own anymore." Fanny nodded slackly again, and I saw that he, too, was on the verge of falling asleep. "You can put your head down," I said. In seconds, both of them were sleeping with their heads on their desks. I could almost have agreed with Gregory's dreadful statement at that moment. It was really as though this was all there was anywhere, just myself and the two exhausted children in a cold barn of a schoolhouse. My sense of reality had had too many knocks. As we three sat in the schoolhouse, the day began to end and the whole area of the room, dim at the best of times, became dark and shadowy. I did not have the heart to turn on the lights, so we sat there as at the bottom of a well. I had promised them that I would find beds in the village, but that miserable little hamlet not 50 paces down the road seemed miles off. And even if I'd had the energy and confidence to leave them alone, I couldn't imagine who'd take them in. If it were a well, it was really a well of hopelessness, and I seemed to myself as lost as the children. Finally, I could stand it no longer, and I went over to Fenny and shook his arm. He came awake like a frightened animal, and I held him on his chair only by using all of my strength. I said, "I have to know the truth, Fenny. What happened to Gregory?"
"He went over," he said, sullen again.
"Do you mean he died?" Fenny nodded, and his mouth dropped open, and again I saw those terrible rotting teeth. "But he comes back?" He nodded again. "And you see him?"
"He sees us," Fenny said, very firmly. "He looks and looks. He wants to touch."
"To touch?"
"Like before."
I put my head on my forehead. It was burning. Every word that Fenny spoke opened a new abyss. "But did you shake the ladder?" Fenny just looked stupidly at his desk, and I repeated my question. "Did you shake the ladder, Fenny?"
"He looks and looks," Fenny said, as if it were the largest fact in his consciousness. I put my hands on his head to make him look up at me, and at that moment the face of his tormentor appeared in the window, that white, terrible face, as if he wanted to stop Fenny answering my questions. I felt sick, dumped back into the pit, but I also felt as if the battle had come at last, and I pulled Fenny toward me, trying to protect him physically. "Is he here?"
Fenny shrieked, and at the sound of his voice, Constance dropped to the floor and began to wail. "What does that matter?" I yelled. "He won't get you. I have you. He knows he's lost you forever."
"Where is he?"
Fenny shrieked again, pushing at me.
"Where is Gregory?"
"There," I said, and turned him around to face the window. He was already jerking himself around, and we both stared then at an empty window. There was nothing out there but an empty, dark sky. I felt triumphant. I had won. I gripped Fenny's arm with all the strength of my victory, and he gave a shout of pure despair. He toppled forward, and I caught him as if he were jumping into the pit of hell itself. Only a few seconds later did I realize what I had caught. His heart had stopped, and I was holding a dispossessed body. He had gone over for good. "And that was it," Sears said, looking at the circle of his friends. "Gregory, too, was gone for good. I came down with a nearly fatal fever. That was what I'd felt on my forehead, and spent 3 weeks in the Mathers' attic room. When I had recovered and could move around again, Fenny was buried. He really had gone over for good. I wanted to quit my job and leave the village, but they held me to my contract and I went back to teaching. I was shattered, but I could go through the motions. By the end of it, I was even using the ferrule. I'd lost all my liberal notions, and when I left, I was regarded as a fine and satisfactory teacher. There is one other thing, though. On the day I left Four Forks, I went for the first time to look at Fenny's grave. It was behind the church next to his brother's. I looked at the two graves. And do you know what I felt? I felt nothing. I felt empty. I felt I'd had nothing at all to do with it.
"What happened to the sister?" asked Lewis.
She was no problem. She was a quiet girl, and people felt sorry for her. I'd overestimated the stinginess of the village. One of the families took her in. As far as I know, they treated her as their own daughter. It's my impression that she got pregnant, married the boy, and left town. But that would have been years later.
Frederick Hawthorne. 1. Ricky walked home, surprised to see snow in the air.
"It's going to be a hell of a winter," he thought. "All the seasons are going funny."
In the glow surrounding the street lamp at the end of Montgomery Street, snowflakes whirled and fell and adhered to the ground for a time before melting. Cold air licked in beneath his tweed topcoat. He had a half-hour walk before him, and he was sorry that he hadn't taken his car. The old Buick Stella happily refused to touch. On cold nights, he usually drove. But tonight, he'd wanted time to think. He had been going to grill Sears on the contents of his letter to Donald Wanderley, and he had to work out a technique. This he knew he'd failed to do. Sears had told him just what he wanted to, and no more. Still, the damage from Ricky's point of view was done. What point was there in knowing how the letter was worded? He startled himself by sighing aloud, and saw his breath send a few big, lazy flakes spinning off in a complicated pattern as they melted. Lately, all the stories, his own included, had made him tense for hours afterward. But tonight he felt more than that. Tonight he felt especially anxious. Ricky's nights were now uniformly dreadful. The dreams of which he had spoken to Sears pursued him straight through until dawn. And he had no doubt that the stories he and his friends told gave them substance. Still, he thought that the anxiety was not due to his dreams, nor was it due to the stories, though Sears's had been worse than most. All of their stories were getting worse. They frightened themselves each time they met, but they continued to meet because not to meet would have been more frightening yet. It was comforting to get together, to see that they were each bearing up. Even Lewis was frightened, or why would he have voted in favor of writing to Donald Wanderley? It was this, knowing that the letter was on its way, ticking away in a mailbag somewhere, that made Ricky more than usually anxious. "Maybe I really should have left this town ages ago," he considered, looking at the houses he passed. There was scarcely one he had not been inside at least once, on business or pleasure, to see a client or to eat a dinner. "Maybe I should have gone to New York back when I got married as Stella wanted to do." It was, for Ricky, a thought of striking disloyalty. Only gradually, only imperfectly, had he convinced Stella that his life was in Milburn, with Sears, James, and the law practice. Cold wind cut into his neck and pulled at his hat. Around the corner ahead of him he saw Sears's long black Lincoln parked at the curb. A light burned in Sears's library.
Sears would not be able to sleep, not after telling a story like that. By now they all knew the effects of reliving these past events.
But it's not just the stories, he thought. No, and it's not just the letter either. Something is going to happen.
That was why they told the stories. Ricky was not given to premonitions, but the dread of the future he'd felt 2 weeks earlier while talking to Sears came thudding back into him again. That was why he had thought of moving out of town. He turned into Melrose Avenue. Avenue, presumably because of the thick trees which lined either side. Their branches stood out gesturally, tinted orange by the lamps. During the day, the last of the leaves had fallen.
Something's going to happen to the whole town.
A branch groaned above Ricky's head. A truck changed gears far behind him, off on Route 17. Sound traveled a long way on these cold nights in Milburn. When he went forward, he could see the lighted windows of his own bedroom up on the third floor of his house. His ears and nose ached with the cold. After such a long and reasonable life, he said to himself, "You can't go mystic on me now, old friend. We'll need all the rationality we can muster up." At that moment, near where he felt safest and with this self-given reassurance in mind, it seemed to Ricky that someone was following him, that someone was standing back on the corner glaring at him. He could feel cold eyes staring at him, and in his mind it seemed that they floated alone, just eyes following him. He knew how they would look, clear, pale, luminous, and floating at the level of his own eyes. Their lack of feeling would be dreadful. They would be like eyes in a mask. He turned around, fully expecting to see them, so great was his sense of them. Abashed, he realized that he was trembling. Of course, the street was empty. It was simply an empty street, even on a dark night as ordinary as a mongrel pup. "This time you really did it to yourself," he thought, "you and that gruesome story Sears told." Eyes. It was something out of an old Peter Lorre film. The eyes of Gregory Bate? Hell. The hands of Dr. Orlack. "It's very clear," Ricky told himself. "Nothing at all is going to happen. We're just four old coots going out of our minds. To imagine that I thought..." But he had not thought the eyes were behind him. He had known it. It had been knowledge. "Nonsense," he almost said aloud, but let himself in his front door a little more quickly than usual. His house was dark, as it always was on Chowder Society nights. By running his fingers along the edge of the couch, Ricky skirted the coffee table, which on other nights had given him a half dozen bruises. Having successfully navigated past that obstacle, he groped around a corner into the dining room and went through into the kitchen. Here he could turn on a light without any possibility of disturbing Stella's sleep. The next time he could do that was at the top of the house, in the dressing room which, along with the horrid, sleek Italian coffee table, had been his wife's latest brainstorm. As she had pointed out, their closets were too crowded. There was no place to store their unseasonal clothes. And the small bedroom next to theirs wasn't likely to be used ever again, now that Robert and Jane were gone. So, for a cost of $800, they'd had it converted into a dressing room, with clothes, rails, and mirrors, and a thick new carpet. The dressing room had proved one thing to Ricky. As Stella had always said, he actually did own as many clothes as she did. That had been rather a surprise to Ricky, who was so without vanity that he was unconscious of his own occasional dandyism.